It's the Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. NPR's How to Raise a Human series has taken on an issue that psychologists and psychiatrists have been watching for years now, the high stressors many of our teens and young adults are under. Allison Aubrey's story Monday focused on how parents might learn to back off from pushing their kids toward their view of success. Allison Aubrey joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Are you a teen or young adult that feels pressure? Are you laying in bed right now just after 6 in the morning and thinking, oh, man, that's me? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Allison, I want to start with the same piece, the same way that your piece starts, with the story of a young woman named Savannah Eason. Tell us about Savannah.
Sure. Savannah is now 23, but in my story, she recalls a very dramatic event that from high school back around 2012, 2013. She was really struggling. Her parents didn't quite get how much she was struggling because on the outside, she was still performing. She was making all A's and B's, taking honors classes, had friends. But on the inside, she felt she wasn't measuring up, and the sort of depression and anxiety started to take over. So on New Year's Eve back in 2012, she went into her bedroom, got a pair of scissors, held them up to her palm as if to cut herself. Her dad intervened, wrestled the scissors from her hands, and that night it became very clear she needed help.
And this wasn't, was this her parents putting pressure on her? Was it the community putting pressure on her? Was it the school putting pressure on her? Like, where does this come from?
All of the above. It's surround sound pressure, I would say. It's in her community, which is a very high-achieving community. Of course, these communities are throughout the country. I mean, this is a high-achieving school, and the research focuses on what happens to upper-middle-class adolescents. But I think this resonates with so many parents because we all want what's best for our kids, right? So I would say, yeah, the pressure is coming, in her case, from peers, from teachers, from the community in general, just from the expectations that sort of hung in the air.
And her dad works in the financial industry, right? So there's this expectation that you're going to make a lot of money, that if your parents make a lot of money, then you should make a lot of money too, right?
That's right. I think what was really interesting is I sat at her kitchen table of her childhood home, and she told me her struggles in high school, how she's kind of come out of them by, in essence, forging her own path, which is very, very different from the kinds of paths that people in her community typically pursue. And I asked her, you know, do you think that you're going to, you know, live here in Wilton, Connecticut? Do you see yourself in this community? And she basically said, like, I don't see myself doing anything that my parents do or many of their friends do. Like, no, this is not my scene here. And her mother sort of looked on smiling, like sort of in celebration that Savannah had sort of forged this different path. I mean, in essence, this woman decided to go to culinary school. She is training to be a pastry chef. She's just tracking in a very different way. It's not, she says, I'm not going to be able to kind of afford the lifestyle to live. The community's called Wilton, Connecticut. It's a very wealthy suburb about an hour and a half outside New York City.
So there's a balance here between having the life you want, having the life that makes you happy, and having the life that society tells you need to have.
That's right. And it can never be one or the other, right? We have to balance achievement with well-being. And no matter where you fall on the income spectrum or the, you know, expectation spectrum, this is something we're all navigating as human beings, as parents, as kids. And it's an ongoing process, I think. I think for people who go through a very dramatic event like this, where anxiety and depression have reached this very high level, to dial back from that and to say, okay, you know what? What's important in life? It might be more important to say, hey, what makes me happy? What makes me well? What makes me, you know, let's focus on well-being here. And so her mother, Genevieve Eason, has become this huge advocate for helping kids and helping the community sort of try to navigate and find that right balance.
Do you think that we put more pressures on kids to be overachievers? We want to take your calls, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Savannah's story, her mother has become this advocate. What about, how are people in the community, in Wilton, kind of reacting to that? I can imagine that a lot of people are like, yeah, you know, now that your child has sort of like jumped off the train, my child has a better chance, and pushing their child even harder.
Yeah, you know, I think, like, you know, any place, there's a range of reactions, right? I mean, most importantly, I would say that this, you know, Genevieve's actions, I'll tell you what she did. She and a bunch of parents, along with counselors in the school, got together and assessed the entire student body. Genevieve's thinking was, you know, if my daughter was struggling, how many other kids are silently struggling? Oftentimes, depression has this, you know, it can go two ways. You'll hear psychologists talk about internalizing symptoms and externalizing symptoms. And when you internalize, you know, you're sad, you're sad, you're blue. On the inside, you're sort of falling apart, but that doesn't always manifest on the outside. And so much of this is hidden. Genevieve's goal was to say, hey, Wilton, how many other
and
families
how many
in our
other
community?
Are there?
Well, it turned out that the entire student body at Wilton High School, or almost the entire student body, took a survey to assess mental health. And a psychologist administered this and analyzed the results. And she said, compared to a national norm of 7% of kids who score high in terms of clinically significant levels of anxiety and depression, 30% of kids in Wilton.
Wow.
So she was saying, you know, levels here are pretty high. So that was sort of a wake-up call to the community, I think. And some people have responded by saying, you know, hey, let's get this conversation started. What do we need to do as a community? I think other people have pushed back a little bit, saying, hey, you know what? We need to be pushing our kids hard. This is how you get ahead. I'm sure there's a range of reactions.
Is the school taking any steps to combat this?
Absolutely. The school principal has been, you know, very open and concerned about what to do here and taking the lead. There's some student initiatives within the school that the school is supporting. There's more training of counselors, many, many, many conversations about how to erase the stigma of mental illness. The school is really embracing this conversation.
Have you talked to people about, you know, Savannah didn't get there by accident. From the moment she was born, probably, or from when she was a little kid, she was seeing signs around her that she needed to be better. Maybe they were coming from her parents. Have you talked to people about what we need to do with our younger children to not send them down that road?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, kids are a mirror of their society and their parents, and they pick up on things really easily. They pick up on what their parents think, you know, is important and what teachers think is important. And so, really, it's hard to throw a program or an initiative at some big problem and say it's going to solve it, because really, it's the problem of us, right? We've created this problem. And so I would say that a couple of things, you know, the first thing is to create awareness, because you can't shift a culture if there's not awareness. So I would say that's happening. The other thing is that there's a recognition that there are tools and skills that people can learn at a fairly young age to learn resiliency, which is the pushback against anxiety and depression. And so, for instance, in Wilton, they're offering this program to elementary school students, and aftercare program. It's called Go Zen, and it's this resiliency training program. I've done quite a bit of report on resiliency training over the years, and there's a pretty solid body of evidence to show that you teach these skills to sixth graders. It's basically like cognitive behavioral therapy. You teach these skills to sixth graders, and guess what? It's helpful. I mean, I think our approach used to be like, wait for somebody to get really anxious and depressed, send them to a psychologist for help, and then they'll get better. And I think there's this shift towards, you know what, we all have this. Anxiety and depression, I mean, particularly anxiety, we all have some level of anxiety, right? Who couldn't use a coping skill to figure out how to back off? I don't know a person alive who couldn't use that. So I feel like there's this idea that, you know, you don't save these tools for people who are sick and depressed. You give them to everybody. You put them into the curriculum. The evidence shows sixth grade is a really great time to introduce them, because people have by sixth grade, kids have enough life experience and cognitive development to sort of learn these tools.
So go Zen. We're going to be teaching yoga in school. That's going to be one of the core
curricula.
It's not yoga.
I mean, it's not yoga. I know people get, you know, make fun of mine.
No, but actually, I think that's a good idea. I'm like, you know, I like yoga.
I mean, yoga might be part of it, but yeah, it's a lot of this, you know, your thoughts aren't you, and back off your thought, and not everything you think is true, and, you know, let's separate where your thoughts have taken you from reality, all of this sort of basic stuff of cognitive behavioral therapy.
We are talking with NPR's Allison Aubrey about her reporting on childhood anxiety. We're going to explore more after the break, and we are taking your calls, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings after this. It's the morning show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking to NPR's Allison Aubrey this morning about childhood anxiety. And in a moment, we'll turn to a UW professor who specializes in helping kids with anxiety. Please give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet WPR Mornings. Are you a teen that is feeling the pressure and listening to us this morning? Have you gotten help for anxiety and depression? What is it like to experience anxiety or depression as a young person? Have your ideas about success for yourself or your children changed? That's 1-800-642-1234. Allison, what made you want to do this story to begin with?
I have teenagers. I'm laughing as you say, hey, if you're a teenager listening, call in. I'll be shocked if a teenager calls
in. Yeah,
true.
Good point.
I'm a teen. I'm a mom. I find this to be a very rich subject. I think the overarching, arching theme of this entire series is that we've moved to this expert culture, right? Like, our kids have problems, we ask an expert. And one of the things that's sort of emerging in a lot of the reporting from around the globe is that in many indigenous cultures, this is just not the way they do things. That there's alloparenting, meaning many stand-ins or other parents. You have aunts and cousins,
right,
and grandmothers and communities, you know, this sort of, it takes a village approach. And, you know, I think a lot of times we suffer in silence with our problems, given our culture, and we might not know. We think, oh my God, is my kid off the rails? Like, how did this happen? And you don't know that your next door neighbor or one of your friends or other people in your community are suffering as well. I just think there's still a whole lot of stigma and silence over these issues. So
right.
Stigma
over mental health issues in general.
Yeah.
And you've reported on that before, haven't you?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, depression is this way undertreated and underreported problem. I mean, people don't get help. I mean, a lot of people do, but still a lot of people don't. And I do think it's because, you know, if you get the flu or you have, you know, whooping cough, didn't get the vaccination, you know, you wouldn't hesitate to reach out to a doctor, but people are very, very hesitant to reach out about feelings of sadness and isolation and blues. And oftentimes people don't even recognize the symptoms.
Yeah, that's true. Especially if it's happening to everybody around them. They just think it's kind of normal life.
Yeah.
We're talking about privileged people. We're talking about people who live in the community of Wilton. But what about people who don't kind of have that privilege? What about kids and young adults in lower income communities? Are they feeling the same kind of thing?
You know what I think is really interesting about this story? I mean, I actually anticipated I'd get a little pushback or criticism of the story because people would be like, oh, please, now we have to worry about the anxiety of rich kids.
Right.
That wasn't the point of the story. The point of the story was not that. I mean, and they're not rich kids. I mean, to be perfectly honest, you see this in high-achieving communities where incomes are high, but not we're not talking the super wealthy here, mm-hmm. right? We're talking about, you know, many, many of the kind of people who listen to NPR and many, many people in our own communities. I thought what was really fascinating about Sunil Luther's research, which I cite in my story, is that she started out as a researcher in the inner city looking at the troubles of in poor schools. And she was documenting anxiety, depression. She was looking at substance use. And she thought to herself, okay, I need a comparison group. Why don't I pick this group over here in, you know, leafy Fairfield County or somewhere in New England or, you know, some high-achieving community. And the expectation was, like, that the problems would be much more pronounced in low-income areas because, obviously, there are a lot of pressures. And what she found was, lo and behold, you know, kids in, it's not just Wilton, it's many, many places that she's looked at where incomes and expectations are high. You see these elevated levels of anxiety, depression, and substance use. And I sort of think of it like it's maybe looks like a bell curve, right? You know, mm-hmm. You have high levels of anxiety, depression, and substance use in inner city communities, and then a kind of is a little bit lower among middle class communities, and then up again for upper income communities. There's not a ton of research on this, but this is what Sunil Luther's research suggests. So it's kind of fascinating.
You know, anecdotally, I have heard people in lower communities, lower income communities, say that when they see drug deals happening, they see the customers are these kind of more wealthy kids from places like Wilton.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the kinds of drugs people use and how people get high, you know, varies from suburbs to inner city, but it's definitely a problem.
So I am also a parent of teens, yep. And what do I look for? I'm a parent of teens who like to push themselves, and I kind of try and pull them back.
Yeah, okay. There
but what do I look for, and what might a parent of a five-year-old look for to maybe head off these issues?
Okay, so good questions. This is going to sound really like obvious, and I can't believe I didn't think of it, having been at this parenting thing for a long time now. But when we were in Wilton, we interviewed a psychologist who's been working in the community, worked in the schools for quite a while, Colleen Fawcett. She's the youth services coordinator in Wilton. And she has a counseling business on the side. And we said to her, okay, what do you think some strategies are for, you know, checking in with your kids? And she said, you ready for this? Ask them. Ask them, am I pushing you too hard? And when she said it, it seemed so simple and so fresh because I had never thought about saying to my kids, I talked to my friends about, like, do you think you were, you know, I talked to my friends about this a lot, but I have never said to my kids, hey, Tommy, hey, Luke, do you think am I pushing you too hard? Am I not pushing you enough? Am I present enough in your life? Am I helping too much, too little? Because guess what? They'll tell you.
Right.
And when I came home, I asked my son, Tommy, who's a rising sophomore. I said to Tommy, I've come from this reporting trip. It's about the perils of pushing kids too hard. I just wanted to ask you something. Do you know what my expectations are of you? Do you think I push too hard? And he said, Mom, I'm not sure what your expectations are of me, but I know what my expectations are of myself, so I'm all good. I thought, okay, got one on the right track.
Yeah.
Anyway, you asked about younger children.
Yeah.
Okay, I think that one of the things I've learned in this reporting is that we structure our kids way too much, and we do it because sometimes out of necessity, we're working, we have to have them in all day aftercare, blah, blah, blah. But when you constantly have somebody else directing your play and directing your activities, you're missing out on the opportunities to navigate social space in a more organic way. And I think that when you let kids play and generate their own ideas, it gives them a sense of security. It gives them a sense of confidence. And one of the underlying factors in anxiety is that you you aren't in control, that someone's always telling you what to do, that you're living up to somebody else's expectations. Mm. And that starts really early on. So I've included in my story a link to something called Let Grow, which is an organization that promotes childhood resilience. It's Lenore Skenazy is the founder of it. I shouldn't say that without knowing, but she's involved with this organization. And she gives these exercises for let grow. One of them is just to give kids more control, ask them to do something that's right on the cusp of what their ability is, mm-hmm. or what their confidence is. So I think that might be a tip for smaller children.
We have been talking to Allison Aubrey. She did a story on childhood and young adult anxiety that aired on Morning Edition on Monday. Allison, thank you for joining us today.
All right, thanks for having me. Have a great day.
We're going to have a link to that on the Morning Show page at WPR.org. I'm Carrie Kaufman, and this is the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about childhood anxiety and pressure this hour, and we're taking your calls, 1-800-642-1234. Do your kids suffer from anxiety or depression? When did you know something was wrong, and what did you do? Have you ever asked your kids whether they feel pressured? Allison just said that was a very simple question that most of us don't think to ask. 1-800-642-1234. Joining us now is Ned Kalin. He is the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He also has a clinical practice. Dr. Kalin, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So how common is childhood anxiety?
So childhood anxiety is one of the most common psychiatric problems that children face. Hmm. And there are variable estimates, but it's estimated, believe it or not, that at any one time, a child or an adolescent during their life may have an anxiety disorder roughly 30% of the time. So 30% of the population is thought to suffer from significant anxiety at some point during childhood or adolescence. At any one time, if you look at children that are suffering from these disorders, roughly 7 to 8% of children have anxiety problems, and another 10 or 12% have depression.
What does this do to children long term? If they have depression and anxiety as children, what happens to them when they're adults?
So the good news is that if we recognize the problem early, we have some really good interventions, and you heard about some of them from your last visitor on the show, and we have other ones as well. The bad news is that most of the time, anxiety and depression in children and during childhood goes unrecognized, or if it is recognized, it doesn't get adequately treated. And when that occurs, there are really significant and serious long-term consequences for children, because what happens is that over time, the symptoms that initially start out accrue from the standpoint of other types of problems. So you can imagine that if you're suffering from anxiety and if you're not functioning well, it affects your school life, it affects your social life, it affects, importantly, the way you see yourself and your self-esteem. As children develop into adolescence and later adolescence, they're exposed to opportunities to use drugs. Drugs can be used frequently for self-medication and then can become habitual and addicting. And so by the time some of these kids get to be young adults or even older adults, they have developed a whole series of problems that are on top of the initial anxiety problem that are very difficult to undo.
You know, I've been in situations where somebody has looked at me and said, I think I'm having a panic attack. Am I having a panic attack? And it's interesting to me that they don't know, and I don't necessarily know what it looks like. So what does it look like when somebody is having an anxiety attack or a panic attack? And are they different?
Yeah, so anxiety comes in lots of different flavors. And frequently, different types of anxiety are mixed together, and one person who struggles with anxiety will frequently have different types of anxiety. And probably the most dramatic form of anxiety is a panic attack. It's something that is very common to all of us. If you survey the population, the adult population, you'll find that the overwhelming majority of adults have experienced what they would consider a panic attack. So what is a panic attack? A panic attack is basically our body's alarm system gets activated, but it gets activated when it's not supposed to get activated. So, the story that we use for patients frequently is that We have evolved this alarm system to survive. It's what keeps us running away from danger and keeps us protected. And when we're in serious life-threatening danger, all of our systems are on go. We release all kinds of hormones and chemicals into our bloodstream and our brain that make us stronger, make us more alert, and make us wary. But people that suffer from panic attacks will frequently have that kind of response with triggers that are not life-threatening and that look to other people to be relatively common types of thing in the environment. And so what will happen to someone is all of a sudden, frequently out of the blue, they will start to feel somewhat anxious and then get very, very anxious and very scared and really sort of, in their sense, start freaking out. And then having heart rate racing, having lots of stomach symptoms, getting dizzy frequently. Sometimes people will worry that they'll pass out.
Yes.
They'll have to stop what they're doing. And frequently, and interestingly, they will freeze in one position where they feel like they literally cannot move their bodies and they just get very still and are in this very sort of scared state. So that's sort of a panic attack at its most dramatic. Usually it doesn't last too long. Frequently it'll last minutes, maybe hours. Some people report even longer, but when it's longer than that, we begin to wonder if it's something else and not simply a panic attack.
We are taking your calls, 1-800-642-1234. Linda from Madison. Welcome to the program, Linda.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much for this topic. It really rings true to our family. We have three daughters, and our youngest struggled tremendously with severe anxiety and depression to the point that she was doing what's called self-harm, which is she was cutting herself, and became severely depressed at the end of high school. Somehow she managed to make it through 1 year of college, but at that point we had to bring her home because her depression and anxiety was so severe. She was cared for by many of your guests, physicians here in Madison, and wound up going into a program in Oconomowoc at Rogers Hospital called Focus, which is a short-term residential program, but really, really struggled to the point that she had multiple suicide attempts.
Wow.
And we were finally instructed to, we had to do something different. So she wound up going to what's called a residential and transitional program out in Texas, where she lived for a year with women who struggled with very much the same symptoms she had. And it took a year, but she has actually moved on with her life. She lives on her own, has rescued a dog. She loves animals and is working in a job with animals. She doesn't want to go back to college, and she wants to, at this point, it's too big of a stressor for her. And but she's doing well. But it's been quite a journey. It was very isolating for our family.
Right.
You know, you have friends and family that are well intentioned and think they understand what you're going through as a family, but they don't. So we've learned a lot. It's been a journey. We've learned a lot through our own family and couples therapy, and we're just so blessed that that she's alive and still with us.
Well, I'm glad for that. I have more questions for you, though. She is your youngest. What did her siblings think?
Her siblings are actually still struggling with it. Our oldest is a physician. My husband's a physician. I'm a nurse. We're a very high-achieving family.
Right.
She's really definitely, our oldest daughter is definitely having a more difficult time kind of understanding what her problems are. I mean, she knows, but she hasn't really internalized them. Our middle daughter, it really is much more understanding and is really the one that our youngest daughter, Caroline, turns to. But we are an overachieving family, and we put a lot of pressures on our kids that we didn't realize that we were. And she was the kind that really internalized her feelings. She was very good at hiding them. So it took a lot for her to be willing to open up and share with us.
And she's the youngest. And so she saw her siblings achieving and you guys achieving and
right.
that. And there's four people above her that you know, she needs to live up to. I get that. Well, I'm glad that things are turning out well, and I'm sorry that you had to go through this. But thank you for sharing. I appreciate that, Linda.
Thanks.
We are talking about childhood anxiety with Dr. Ned Kalin. He's the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine. We will take more of your calls at 1-800-642-1234 after this. It's the Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We are talking with Dr. Ned Kalin of the UW School of Medicine and Public Health about childhood anxiety. His research focuses on anxiety, and he also talks to kids in a clinical setting. Do you have anxiety or depression? Are you a teen? Are you a parent of a teen, one that just called in who has dealt with anxiety and depression? 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. I want to share, there was one teen who called in and said that he's a teenager. He had recently graduated from high school. He sees a lot of kids under pressure from adults. He says his mom wanted him to be a doctor, but he wanted to be an engineer. He says other groups of young people don't realize that they have a choice and don't have to give into parental pressure. And he says he did not. Please give us a call, 800-642-1234. Dr. Kalin, I want to follow up on something that the caller just said, that her daughter was cutting. Why do people cut?
So, we really don't understand all the elements that lead to why people harm themselves. But for sure, behaviors like cutting or other self-harm behaviors are frequently related to a variety of things. One is sometimes it's a call for help. One of the cases that we heard about, actually, on your earlier show, I think there was a case where a child was harming themselves with a scissors, mm-hmm. and father intervened, and then the child got help. Other children will develop, or adolescents will develop, habits of self-harm that are self-punishing types of behaviors that they keep secret, and are their ways of punishing themselves in a very negative and harmful kind of way. And interestingly enough, some people that suffer from self-harm types of behaviors say that by engaging in those behaviors, they actually feel better, or in some ways, it relieves some of the psychological distress and pain that they have. I should say that most people and most children and adolescents that suffer from anxiety and depression do not get into those types of behaviors, but there are a subset that do. And for sure, those are very disturbing and alarming behaviors that need to be addressed when they occur.
Joseph from Madison joins us right now. Joseph, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you. I have a 16-year-old son who has been struggling with this now for probably, well, I don't know how long, but most definitely for over the last 2 years. We've tried counseling. We've tried medication. But he totally now refuses any kind of treatment. He will not have anything to do with any kind of meds. He will not see any kind of counseling. And, you know, it's kind of left us in a lurch as to, well, where do you go, you know, from there?
Dr. Kalin, where do you go from there?
So that's not uncommon, and it's also obviously very, very difficult for families and for parents. And I guess there are two things that I would think about. One is to try to engage your son in a discussion about what his negativity and resistance is to getting help, try to dispel whatever it is that is you know, keeping him from doing that. The second thing is that if he doesn't get help, I think parents can get help. And sometimes by getting help for the parents, they become more capable of either interacting with the child in a way to get them help, or actually changing their behaviors in a way that in an unaware way that they may be already contributing to some of the stresses and struggles that the child is feeling. And by doing that, that helps the child and also can help the child get some help at some point.
Thank you, Joseph, for sharing that. Good luck. And keep us posted. We also have Fred, who joins us from Waukesha. Fred, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So your question, your comment, sir.
Yes, my question is, I work with adolescents here in Waukesha County, and the previous caller talked about services that they were able to provide to their daughter. because they're a physician and a nurse, and so they have the income to do that and the insurance. We work with so many families who don't have those finances to be able to provide services to their children. And I'm wondering if there's some kind of a resource for families with no insurance or very little insurance, because oftentimes these youth and young people who are experiencing anxiety and depression end up in the juvenile justice system, which mirrors a lot of times the adult system. And so they're not getting the services that they need, partly because of finances.
Yeah, Dr. Kalin, I actually also have friends who had a child who was having panic attacks. That's where that question came from. And their father made sure to get a job with insurance so that they could take their son into treatment.
Well, you know, the problems that we just heard about from the standpoint of having the resources to take care of the medical needs of our children and our families are not specific to psychiatry. And unfortunately, this is a generic problem across all of the medical problems that we face. And, you know, we're sorely underfunded for the types of care that we need to provide for families that don't have the means to get the help they need. From a psychiatric and anxiety and depression standpoint, there are county resources, but frequently some of the county resources actually have been limited based on state budget issues. There are also some internet resources. And, you know, I would think that if nothing else, there are tools on the internet. And actually, I think some resources that were posted on your website, perhaps in relation to the last discussion, that families and children actually could access to begin to learn more about the problem and also to think about other ways to help. There are also a number of self-help resources and books that are out there that can be useful as well. So while it's not ideal, there are a lot of resources that are available free of charge, both on the internet through some of the societies. Another society that is helpful is the American Anxiety Disorders and Depressive Association, ADAA. So I would try to tap into some of those resources.
So thank you, Fred, for joining us. I have a follow-up to that, Dr. Kalin. If somebody does have insurance and they're listening to this show and thinking, yeah, maybe I need to get my kid in to see somebody, and they live in Wisconsin, what's the first step they should take?
Well, the first step is to call the medical group that they belong to and to talk about the problem and to get a referral either to a psychiatrist or to a psychologist or to a therapist. I would urge family members to take, as we heard before, to take very seriously any concerns that they detect or concerns that a child expresses and to go for help. So I'd first contact the medical group that folks are involved with, and then I would insist that the child and the parents together see a trained counselor, psychologist, or psychiatrist for an initial evaluation.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. We are taking your calls in the last couple of minutes here, 800-642-1234. We actually have an email. Grant from Madison emailed us, and it points to schools. He says he sees young adults in college who come to UW having had that high achiever as an important part of their personality. If they get to college and don't have the same level of success because they're now paired with other high achievers, these students can slip into depression. It's very competitive at some of the courses at UW, and the colleges and the high schools contribute to this. What do you say to that?
I think that's absolutely true. I think the pressures that children face from the standpoint of achievement, as they interact with individual personalities, can really result in depression and significant anxiety, especially around transition periods, like going to college, like going to high school, like making transition sometime even to middle school. And, all of us need to be aware of that, recognize it, and destigmatize the whole ideas about struggling with those types of problems. The issue really is not that people are struggling with the problems. It's that the issue is that people are not asking for or getting the help that they need, because there is a lot that we can do to help people. And one of the big issues is the sort of societal stigma that we still have about struggling with depression, anxiety, that these are personal weaknesses, that there's things we can't talk about, that they that by having this we're letting our parents down, you know, that there's something wrong and defective about us. And all of that is absolutely not true.
Marcus from Milwaukee joins us. Marcus, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. So I would make the argument that we need to change our perspective, and that instead of these being weaknesses, I would argue that these are actually can become strengths. I personally, in my teen years, suffered from depression and anxiety, and it was mostly undiagnosed. But as I got older, I found that from being under that pressure, that I was better able to deal with a whole wider variety of situations as an adult. And there's many famous examples of other people like Nikola Tesla, like Winston Churchill, like Ernest Hemingway, where they suffered in their younger years and then were able to turn it into a strength in their later years, which really helped them achieve great things.
It's character building. Actually, Winston Churchill talked about that too, Dr. Kalin. What do you say to that?
Well, I think it's double-edged. I absolutely agree that having difficult experiences can build character, and if dealt with appropriately and under the right circumstances, can build resilience and even push achievement in healthy ways. On the other hand, there are many multitudes of people that don't have that pathway and that end up going in the opposite direction, which is a sort of a spiraling down kind of direction where they become more and more disabled and more dysfunctional and have multiple problems. So it really depends on the resources that an individual has, how severe the problem is, and frankly, some of the circumstances that they encounter as they develop from the standpoint of having support, mentoring, opportunities, things like that.
Marcus, thank you for being with us. Dr. Kalin, you have about 30 seconds. What is the one thing you want to say to people who may be seeing a depression and anxiety in their kids?
Well, what I would emphasize is that these are common problems, they're treatable problems, and there's nothing to be ashamed of for parents or for children. The most important thing is to try to provide an environment where children are comfortable talking about it with parents, and parents in a non-judgmental way can listen and hopefully get help for the children that are suffering as well as for themselves and the family.
And lots of hugs. Hugging helps?
Hugging helps. Love helps.
Dr. Ned Kalin is the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Thank you for joining us today. This was a fascinating discussion.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Coming up tomorrow at this time, how to be a tourist in your own state. Boy, that's a switch. That would be Wisconsin here. It's the morning show, and this is the Ideas Network.